In her new book, One Person, No Vote, today's guest, Professor Carol Anderson, says Donald Trump would not be in the White House without voter suppression. So how did voter suppression affect the recent midterms? While voter turnout was 10 percentage points higher than 2014, 120 million eligible voters did not cast a ballot. When Republicans pass voter suppression laws, their ultimate goal is to block people of color from voting. From the 2000 election to 2018, they have been wildly successful. So what can we do to stop voter suppression and ensure one person, one vote? Join us after the news.
Hello, I'm Julie Candler with the BBC News. A new UN report has warned that not enough effort is being made to tackle global warming, with greenhouse gas emissions reaching a record high last year. Roger Harabin reports.
Today's document traces the gap between what governments need to do to tackle climate change and what they are actually doing. It shows that after an optimistic three-year spell in which emissions from industry stabilised, they're now back on the increase. Analysts hoped that brief stabilisation was conjured by clean technology. Now they suspect the economic slowdown was the main cause. The report says half of the G20 leading nations are not on a path towards fully meeting their promises on greenhouse gases. That includes the USA and Britain. Of the G20, just Brazil, China and Japan are on track.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has said recent nationwide fuel tax protests will not stop France moving to cleaner energy. He justified his radical policy on the grounds of fighting climate change, as well as furthering social justice and national sovereignty. Mr. Macron wants all coal-fired power stations in France closed by 2022 and French energy to be wholly decarbonised by 2050. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has arrived in Tunisia as part of his first foreign trip since the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Earlier, hundreds of people in the capital Tunis protested against his visit. Sebastian Usher reports.
Several hundred Tunisians, including journalists, students and women's rights activists, have marched through Tunis to express their anger that Mohammed bin Salman should be welcomed by their government. Their chants denounced the Saudi Crown Prince as a murderer, while a huge banner depicted him with a chainsaw, the means by which Jamal Khashoggi was dismembered, according to Turkish sources. Mohammed bin Salman is making a tour of Arab states but seems aimed at maintaining his international legitimacy. He's so far been to the UAE, Bahrain and Egypt, which are all close allies of the Crown Prince.
The final of South American football's leading club competition, the Copa Libertadores, has been moved from Argentina to a neutral venue abroad. Fan violence caused the second leg of the game between two Buenos Aires rivals to be called off at the weekend. More from Alex Capstick.
A statement from CONMEBOL, football's governing body in South America, said the final will be decided on either December the 8th or the 9th at a venue yet to be determined. The second leg was cancelled at the weekend after River Plate fans attacked the Boca team bus on its way to the ground. Some players were injured. It seems a request from Boca to have River Plate disqualified has been denied. The decision to move the match away from Argentina may have been influenced by the G20 summit, which starts in Buenos Aires later this week and will involve a huge security operation.
World news from the BBC. A court in Germany has sentenced a Russian-born German man to 14 years in jail for bombing a coach carrying the Borussia Dortmund football team. Prosecutors said Sergei Venegold stood to make hundreds of thousands of dollars through a fall in the club's share price and had left fake evidence at the scene pointing to an Islamist attack. The Facebook executive Richard Allen has been quizzed in London by 24 parliamentarians from 9 countries at an international hearing over the company's use and treatment of personal data. An empty chair was left for the Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, who once again declined to be questioned. There were lively exchanges, such as this one between Mr. Allen and the Canadian MP Bob Zimmer, over allegations that Facebook had allowed Cambridge Analytica to continue its political interference, this time in US midterm elections.
There was two media reports of Cambridge Analytica, this is the group that's supposed to be banned from Facebook, still ran ads under that banner for 2 weeks, and it wasn't caught by the $13 billion quarterly company that's Facebook. How do you answer those questions?
Without
just another apology.
No, we're making those investments, but I think, this goes to the heart of the problem. We now have, I think, a world-leading security team who are finding and catching those people and taking them down. And if we tell you about it, you say, well, how did they get on there? Well, they get on there because they are cunning and clever, and we need to stay ahead of them.
A national treasurer in the government of the former Venezuela President Hugo Chavez has been sentenced by a US court to 10 years in jail for money laundering. Alejandro Andrade admitted to accepting $1 billion in bribes and laundering the money through properties in South Florida and other investments. Reports from Niger say the authorities have ordered the closure of two centres run by the British charity Marie Stopes International because they were illegally performing abortions. Niger only allows abortions if the mother's life is in danger. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In this year's midterm elections, voter turnout was 10 percentage points higher than it was in the 2014 midterms, but nearly 120 million eligible voters did not cast a ballot. Today's guest, Professor Carol Anderson, says low voter turnout happens because Republicans across the country systematically block people of color from voting. This is the continuation of a long history of racist voter disenfranchisement in the United States. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, between 2014 and 2016, just 2 years, nearly 16 million voters were purged from the rolls nationwide. They were just taken off of the voting rolls. People of color were disproportionately impacted. Carol Anderson says if it weren't for voter suppression, Donald Trump would not be in the White House. So how did voter suppression shape the outcome of key races in the 2018 midterms? Carol Anderson is professor of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of several books, including White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, and One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Hi, Carol. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you so much for joining us. I have to say, these shows really get under my skin. I mean, I read the amazing story you wrote for the New York Times back in September, The Republican Approach to Voter Fraud Lie. We'll talk about that. Really incredible piece. You also just wrote a piece for The Guardian called Why Is No One Talking About the Uncounted Suppressed Votes in Florida? You've been speaking extensively about Georgia. So what really stands out for you, Carol, when you look at how voter suppression affected the midterms?
What stands out is that there was a Herculean grassroots effort, get out the vote effort, where people are knocking on doors, getting folks registered to vote, getting people to the polls, taking voter suppressors to court over and over and over. And there was a massive turnout. But when you think about it, that massive turnout still did not result in the kind of definitive wins across the board that one would expect to see. And that is because of the power of voter suppression. And what I mean by that, for instance, is, like, let's take Georgia. In Georgia... you know, there was a razor-thin percentage point victory, and I put that victory in quotes, for Brian Kemp, who was the Secretary of State who was running for governor. And in the Georgia election, you had where his office had put 53,000 voter registrations in electoral limbo. 70% of those were African-American, where you had 4.5-hour waits in a area of Metro Atlanta, where you didn't have enough provisional ballots. In another area, the Atlanta University Center with Morehouse, Clark Atlanta, Spelman. I mean, these are the kinds of activities that were being taken place to begin to shave off, to cull out a part of the electorate that he suspected would not vote for him. And so the way that voter suppression works is that it's very clinical like that. It's not like you see the big blow-up on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, but when you think about 16 million people being wiped off of the voter rolls, so these are people who were on the rolls, we didn't see it. We did not see it. It's not visible. It's just 16 million people removed. And, of course, there are logical reasons for voter roll maintenance. Somebody dies. Somebody moves out of the voting jurisdiction. But those numbers of 16 million don't align with the numbers of the reasonable, logical purposes why people would be removed off of the rolls.
You have also pointed out that Brian Kemp closed 214 polling places, most in neighborhoods where poor people live and people of color live. And you just repeated that number, the 53,000 registered voters that were on hold. 70% of those voters were African American. So do we know, were those 53,000 people either turned away from the polls or were they not, quote, allowed to vote?
You know, I don't know that yet, but I know that there was one of my colleagues, a professor at Emory. She was put on that roll, for instance, that pending roll, the electoral limbo purgatory roll. And the notice that she received said that there was a discrepancy between her voter registration card and the information that is in the state's driver's database. Now, what that discrepancy is, we don't know. And so when Brian Kemp gets on TV being very dismissive about 53,000 being put on hold, and he says, oh, all you got to do is just go to the polls and show your ID, you don't know which ID. Is the discrepancy my married name, so you need my marriage license? Is the discrepancy my birth name, so you need my birth certificate? Is the discrepancy having something to do with where you need my tax return? Because you don't, the discrepancy is not identified. It creates confusion. And confusion at the polls is one of the key methods for voter suppression.
So according to the official tally, Brian Kemp won the Georgia governor's race by 54,723 votes. Okay, 54,000. He, again, removed, I want to get my numbers right, 53,000 voters from the polls. But you have also pointed out that since 2012, his office canceled 1.4 million voter registrations.
Yes, and in the past 2 years, from 2016 to 2018, the Brennan Center notes that he has removed 10.6% of voters from the rolls in Georgia. 10.6% of the voters removed. And so these kinds of activities, and then let's just also be very clear here. He remained Secretary of State, so in charge of the elections, while he was running for governor. He only stepped down after his office certified him as the winner. The kinds of ethical and integrity challenges that brings up is monumental. President Jimmy Carter had asked him to step down because legitimate elections require the kind of credibility that means that you don't have the person in charge of the election running for election where he can certify himself that he won the election. I liken it to the director of the lottery during that $1 billion lottery, right? The director of the lottery certifies that the balls are working, yeah, and certifies that the machines are good, yeah, and then pulls the ticket and says, hey, I won! And right? And we would look at that going, oh yeah, right. And it's the same thing. When you have the Secretary of State certifying that the machines are what they are and that everything is fine, everything is good, and everything is counted, and therefore he won, your eyebrow and more needs to go up. We had long lines here in the Atlanta area, hours-long lines. But we also had, it turns out, that the Secretary of State had over 700 voting machines in a warehouse not put into service. One of the ways that you create voter suppression are by those long lines. People waiting in line during on a Tuesday, during a work day. It was like 4.5 hours up in Snelling. People are like, okay, I've got to get to work or my pay is going to get docked. Now we're talking about a poll tax. Right. But when you don't have enough machines in service, in Snelling, they didn't have the power cords. Wow. Yeah.
What is the response to this, Carol? Because as you write in your excellent piece in the New York Times, which we'll talk about, you point out that this all started really with a vengeance in 2000. I mean, George W. Bush, you can also say, won because of voter suppression. And
absolutely.
I hit my head against the wall just thinking, where are the politicians that oppose this kind of voter suppression? I mean, the grassroots groups are doing an excellent job, but there's so much going on right now for them to tackle with very little, few resources. So where is the opposition to this? Why is it taking so long?
That's a great question. And I think it is finally beginning to come to the fore. I think part of what we're dealing with is almost a disbelief that that this kind of chicanery is really going on, or that the American system can withstand it. It cannot. It has never been able to withstand this kind of massive disfranchisement and assault on democracy. And I think the other thing is a concern about the question of legitimacy. And so to say that that wasn't a legitimate election, think about the backlash that Stacey Abrams received when she said, oh, this isn't a concession speech. I'm saying that he won. You know, he's the legal governor, but he's not the legitimate one. And people are like, oh, I don't believe she said that. I am so glad she said that. And this is where I'm thinking you're beginning to see the turn where those who have been directly affected and those who understand how this system has been, how American citizens have been systematically denied their right to vote, how that creates a massive assault on democracy, how that brings into question the legitimacy of these elections, and that we need to call it out and we need to put in place the kinds of safeguards that prevent this from happening and provide consequences for those who do this kind of devilment.
The Rolling Stone has a great piece about Stacey Abrams. They interviewed her after the election. It's called The Exit Interview. And here's what she said when she gave a speech. She said, quote, "Concession means to acknowledge an action is right, true, or proper. As a woman of conscience and faith, I cannot concede. But my assessment is that the law currently allows no further viable remedy," end quote. So what she has done is she and others have launched an organization called Fair Fight. And it says, "We know that elections in Georgia and throughout much of our country are not fair. Voters are being suppressed and disenfranchised systematically. We are fighting to change that." So, Carol, given all of the work you've done on this issue, what would you say is the most effective thing people can do to fight this issue?
I think there's several things that we have to do. And we also have to keep in mind that one of the reasons why this thing has exploded like mad crazy is the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. Mm. And so one of the first things is to require the accountability of our elected officials to honor the right to vote. That means a new Voting Rights Act. It means that we need to elect secretaries of state who believe in democracy and who do not believe in voter suppression. And you can tell that by the way they talk. If they start using the language of voter fraud, you know they're working to rig the system because voter fraud is a myth. And, you know, it's a major part of what I talked about in that New York Times piece. We need to have, as I said, secretaries of state who really do believe in democracy and who are figuring out ways how to expand access to the ballot box for the electorate, for American citizens. And it's places like Oregon that have automatic voter registration. To lower the barriers, the hurdles, the obstacle courses that we have put in front of people who are just trying to vote. We need to have, as I said, to hold also our elected officials accountable. When they are, like in the current confirmation hearings for a federal judge for Thomas Farr, when we have elected officials who see absolutely nothing wrong with putting a known voter suppressor on the federal bench, we need to hold those folks accountable at the polls. And that requires, again, this massive voter turnout. And that massive voter turnout that we had in the midterms, frankly, scared the bejeebers. And that's the technical term. because it showed that the lies weren't working, not as well as they thought they were. It showed that people want a true, viable democracy. They want representatives that look like America. And that is absolutely frightening. And I'm really zeroing in on the Republicans right now, because they have crafted policies that are so far outside the parameters, the mainstream of American society, that are so far right wing that their policies cannot speak to America, the broader America. And so that's why they double down on voter suppression. They're going to double down more. That requires that elected officials who are in there now understand what the language is that they're using and what the implications are, and that they fight with every bureaucratic Roberts Rules of Order tool that they have. It requires that we call into our elected officials, letting them know that we're watching and we will be there come next election to hold them accountable.
Today we are speaking with Carol Anderson, professor of African American Studies at Emory University and author of several books, including White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, and One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. And you can find Carol's latest pieces at yourcallradio.org. It is so important to talk about voter suppression, not just 2 months before the election, but also after the election and when we're on an off year. This issue is so incredibly important. If you have any questions for Carol or comments about voter suppression, did you encounter any trouble when you voted? Do you know anyone in some of these states that have voter suppression laws that were not able to vote if they've been purged from the rolls? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Carol, we've done a lot of shows about the Voting Rights Act, but it's important to revisit this. Let's just talk about the significance of that Supreme Court decision back in June 2013. And I'm just reading from a New York Times piece. The Supreme Court effectively struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 by a 5-4 vote, freeing 9 states, mostly in the South, to change their election laws without advanced federal approval. And Chief Justice John Roberts, who now is going to be, you know, the swing vote on the Supreme Court, a very conservative justice at that time. I mean, it's really amazing. He said, quote, "Our country has changed. While any racial discrimination in voting is too much, Congress must ensure that the legislation it passes to remedy that problem speaks to current conditions," end quote. Well, here we are 5 years right later. Gosh, it's already been 5 years. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Talk about how significant this decision was.
This decision, I think, will go down in the annals the way Plessy v. Ferguson has. in the ways that it undermined and undercut all of the progress that this nation was working so desperately to achieve. What the Shelby County v. Holder decision did was to ignore that Shelby County had violated the Voting Rights Act as it drew its districts to ensure that the lone black councilman in Calera City was not reelected. And then what it did was to create the myth of a whole brand new America where racism really wasn't a viable force. And that was to ignore then the evidence from the 2006 Reauthorization Act of the Voting Rights Act, reauthorization hearings from the Voting Rights for the Voting Rights Act, that showed that the Department of Justice had blocked over 700 changes that these states had tried to make because these changes were racially discriminatory. So within 2 hours after the Shelby County v. Holder decision, Texas passed SB 14. Which was its voter ID law. What that voter ID law did was to say you had to have government-issued photo ID, but only certain types of government-issued photo ID. The NAACP and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund found that 1.6 million Texans, overwhelmingly black, Latino, and poor, did not have the kind of ID that Texas required to be able to vote. More than that, though, is that one-third of the counties in Texas did not have a Department of Motor Vehicles where you could, like, get a driver's license. And Texas had eliminated the language in the law that was going to provide for reimbursement for people who had to make over, I believe it was like a 200-mile round trip in order to be able to get that license. So on the backs of African Americans, Latinos, and the poor, Texas passes a law that says you need to have this ID in order to vote, but the readily accessible ID is really not readily accessible. So this is the way that you create an obstacle. You need an ID, and then you create an obstacle to an obstacle. We don't have enough Department of Motor Vehicles in the places where you live, and we're not providing any kind of reimbursement for you to go get one either. So fund it out of your own pocket. That's what Texas did.
And on your point, just quickly, in Texas, I mean, when you look at the results between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke, with over 8 million people voting in this massive state, Ted Cruz only won by 219,000 votes. 219,427 to be exact.
Okay. This is exactly what I mean. What we see, for instance, is that they crafted the law so that your student ID from a state university, like the University of Texas, doesn't count for government-issued photo ID. But your gun registration does, because they know, or they firmly believe, that there is a party bias in certain types of ID. So that is why you privilege one over the other. This thing, yeah, is rigged. North Carolina got shot down by the Fourth Circuit that said you have targeted African Americans with nearly surgical precision, because the North Carolina state legislature immediately requested data based on race for voting. And, for instance, and looked at the kinds of IDs that African Americans had and didn't have, and then crafted the voter ID law based on the kind that African Americans did not have. North Carolina also looked at early voting. Early voting deals with a way to mitigate having elections on Tuesday when people are working. Early voting allows working class folk to be able to exercise their voting rights and not have to take a hit in their paycheck because they've got to take time off of work on that Tuesday. Early voting is a way to again, broaden access to the polls. What North Carolina did was to find out what were the days or the weeks when African Americans voted in large numbers. And then the North Carolina legislature eliminated those days, including Souls to the Polls, which was the Sunday before the Tuesday election. And that is when, coming out of church, they would hop on the church bus and then go drive to the polls, Souls to the Polls. And so this also gets at this thing about, this is why, frankly, my eyes roll on the God-fearing Christians, because they sat there and they eliminated folks coming out of church to not be able to go vote. So, you know, yeah, right. So this is what Shelby County v. Holder unleashed. It unleashed this kind of rampant, targeted voter suppression, but they did it as masterfully as Mississippi did in 1890, because they know they can't say we don't want black people to vote, because that violates the 15th Amendment. So what they do is they go after the societally created conditions in those communities and then make that the litmus test. Things like poverty, things like you work, things like the distance to the polls. And so the shutting down, for instance, here in Georgia of 214 polling stations, wow, most of them in minority and poor neighborhoods. We know from the research that the further the distance is away from the black community, black voter turnout goes down by a certain percentage. And so if you create enough distance, you can drop black voter turnout precipitously. One of the stunts they tried to pull was in Sparta, Georgia, where, and it's always under the guise of something reasonable, sounding reasonable, for fiscal constraints, we're going to have poll consolidation because we have to really manage our budget. When they did that in Sparta, then the polling station for the black community was put 17 miles away.
Wow.
The one in Macon, Georgia, was put in the sheriff's office. That was, I've got to tell you, I love civil society. Civil society rose up and said, not today, and fought and fought and fought and got the polling station moved out of the sheriff's office in Macon and got one much closer to the black community than 17 miles away in Sparta. But we also saw here in Randolph County, Georgia, where, again, civil society had to stand up because they were getting ready to close 7 of the 9 polling stations in Randolph County, which is over 60% black, and which was going to require that African Americans go about 10 miles to the nearest polling station to vote. Without the protection of the Voting Rights Act, these states, these basically Republican governed states. This is where you have a unitary structure of a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. They have gone hog wild under the banner, though, of protecting the integrity of the ballot box and stopping massive, rampant voter fraud.
And it has been wildly successful, unfortunately, in the governor's race in Georgia. Brian Kemp, after almost 4 million people cast their ballots, he got 54,723,000 votes. 54,723,000 votes, more than Stacey Abrams. Today, we are speaking with Carol Anderson, professor of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of many important books, including One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. And I'm sure that many of you listening are infuriated by what you are hearing. And we're going to talk about what else people can do about this. And again, I keep asking the same question, but why don't we hear more about this from politicians who oppose this kind of voter suppression? This is your call. We'll be back after this.
It's been called a misplaced adventure. A young American missionary dies on a remote Indian island. Expeditions like this have long attracted those eager to visit untouched corners of the world, and their big business. When it comes to travel, should some parts unknown stay that way? Next time on 1A.
You can hear 1A 1/2 hour from now at 11 o'clock, right after your call here on 91.7 KALW. This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free from anywhere, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment or question on the website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the Affordable Care Act. Open enrollment runs through December 15th. It has been shortened by the White House. They have also slashed budgets for marketing and advertising, so it's really important to get the word out. We're finding that prices are dropping in many states, but fewer people are signing up. So we will talk about the pricing and the quality of coverage. If you have any questions about healthcare, I hope you can join us tomorrow. And then Thursday, we will talk about the ongoing hotel strike, hotel workers in San Francisco and Honolulu. They've been striking for just over 50 days. And so we're going to get an update on that important strike. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about voter suppression laws, which predominantly affect communities of color. We're joined by Carol Anderson, professor of African American Studies at Emory University, author of many important books, including One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Marie-Louise calling from San Leandro. Hi, Marie-Louise. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. Thank you. I'm very happy that you're bringing up this topic again, but I have to tell you, I'm extremely frustrated and heartbroken. I've been listening to your show for years, over 20 years, and this is not a new issue, as you well know. You've had many of these shows. What are we doing as Democrats, as people who are active? Why can't we make a difference sooner in the year? You know, the time to start taking action against this kind of voter suppression is now. It's not like 3 months before we vote, you know? And I never hear anything about it except what negative things are happening in this state and that state, the jerry-rigging, the this, the that. And the Democratic Party has never stood up as one and responded. I mean, we are fighters out here in the lowlands. We're fighters. We want to do something. Unfortunately, California, we're all, you know, so many of us are Democrats. We don't have to fight in our own backyard. But we're willing to make those phone calls. It's just that we don't have anybody rallying us. You know what I mean? I don't know what to do on my own. But you know what? From now on, I'm calling Eric Swalwell's office directly every week to find out what's happening with this voter suppression problem. I really am. I've made a determination. I'm going to be the change I want to see. You know what I mean? So yes. I want to know what really positive action can we take to keep this from happening in our next election cycle.
I hear you. Thank you, Marie-Louise. Carol?
Thank you. Yeah, I love it. I love it. So, yes, you call your representative. And one of the things is that I believe that the Democratic Party has finally heard us. I'm seeing that on the top of their agenda is a renewal of the Voting Rights Act. And dealing with these issues, getting automatic voter nationwide automatic voter registration. We know we're going to have to come through a Republican dominated Senate, but let the Republicans in the Senate say they don't believe in democracy. Put them on record. And so, and we continue to push our representatives who are Democrats, and we continue to push our representatives who are Republicans. because it is absolutely essential. American democracy is not a partisan issue. They have made it a partisan issue because their policies do not resonate with America. That's not America's fault. That's theirs, and they need to come to grips with it. And so, yes, well, what we do is we hold folks accountable.
So you live in Georgia, right, Carol?
Yes, Lord.
What happens at the local and the state level when these voter suppression laws are passed? Is there much pushback from the Democrats in Georgia?
There was initially, for instance, when Georgia passed a voter ID law in 2006, I believe. I'm a historian, bad with dates, but in I think it was 2006, the African American and Hispanic legislators were raising 10 tons worth of hell, and the Republicans just did not care. At the time, though, there was a the Department of Justice, Georgia was still under preclearance. And so then the Democrats took those concerns to the DOJ saying, look, there is a they've just passed a voter ID law. They didn't do any of the work to figure out the impact on minority voters. We think that there's a problem here. The staff attorneys at the Department of Justice did some heavy, heavy investigation and found out that the voter ID law was, in fact, racially discriminatory. Now, this is the Bush Department of Justice, W's. The staff attorneys were overruled the next day by a political appointee that allowed the voter ID law to stay in place, one of the most racist and restrictive voter ID laws in the nation. So, yeah. So understand, there's been fight. There's been fight. Yeah. But the fight has to be further sustained. It has to be broader. And we have to get the word out because this gets hidden under the language of bureaucracy. Under the, like I said, you don't see the big kind of blow up like you see on the, you saw on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Instead, it's these bureaucratic tweaks that are so hidden that we don't see how they're just sawing away at the sinews of American democracy.
Well, and this is why media are so important. What Yes. are your thoughts about how the media now cover this? Because like in your New York Times piece, when you touch on and you write about this lie about voter fraud, I mean, but that just caught on from the New York Times to NPR and every outlet in between. You heard about voter fraud over and over again. What do you think about how the media cover this? Do you think that they're being honest about what we're really facing here?
No. That was the long and the short answer of it. And I really think that part of it is that the kind of quick catchphrase, voter fraud, it's quick, it's encapsulated, and it begins to suggest all of those kinds of wonderful things that lead to great stories, great clicks, higher advertising revenues, the whole nine yards. Voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. If you say the lie over and over, and I've got to be fair here. When the St. Louis Post-Dispatch heard U.S. Senator Kit Bond say voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud, and followed by Secretary of State Matt Blunt, voter fraud, voter fraud, and then Bond takes that into Congress and embeds it in the Help America Vote Act. Wow. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch did a deep investigative dive on every one of Bond's charges and found out that they didn't hold water. So it's not just that the media, so we do have media who are doing the work, but the lie of voter fraud, because it's playing to so many tropes in American society that are deeply embedded. If you'll note, when they're talking about voter fraud, they're placing that fraud in big cities. And so it's then linking the urban areas, which is then linking African Americans with fraud, with stealing elections. And so that line, that thought process of black criminality plays beautifully into the language of voter fraud. It is Trump, when he's in rural Pennsylvania, talking about sending his squad up to Philadelphia to stop all of this voter fraud from happening. Wow. Yes.
Well, and the thing about the Republicans are so good with their messaging. It's very simplistic, and they all repeat the same talking points over and over and over again. And then the right-wing media do the same thing, and all of a sudden it trickles down to the rest of the media.
Yes. And so voter fraud, because I've been saying it's a fallacy. So let me talk about what I mean by that, so I'm really clear. Justin Levitt, who is a law professor out of California, he did a study from 2000 to 2014. He counted up all of the votes in the United States, and there were a billion votes with a B. He found that there were 31 cases of voter fraud out of those 1 billion votes over 15 years. So we're talking about 2 cases per year. That's hardly the massive rampant that we hear echoed over and over and over. Again, when the voter suppressors themselves have to go before a federal judge and explain why these voter suppression laws are so necessary, and they yell massive rampant voter fraud. And like when Judge Ramos looked at Greg Abbott down in Texas and said, okay, show me. And he's like, massive, rampant. She's like, show me. Rampant, massive, show me. Mm. And he had 2 cases. 2.
Wow.
In Texas. When Chris Kobach out of Kansas, who is like, he's with Brian Kemp in terms of being one of the kings of voter suppression. When he's before a federal judge to justify the kinds of restrictions that he has put on access to the ballot box in Kansas as the Secretary of State, and he says, we have all of these non-citizens voting. And she's like, okay, show me. And he's like, we have a lot of them. Show me. And he can't. So when the voter suppressors themselves, like Trump's Election Integrity Commission that he created because he swore that there were 3 to 5 million illegal votes cast, or he would have won the popular vote too. And so this group, headed by Mike Pence and Chris Kobach, go out looking for massive, rampant voter fraud. Well, one of the Democrats on the committee did basically a FOIA request and got the report. And the section on massive rampant voter fraud is blank because they couldn't find it. So when the voter suppressors themselves are hollering voter fraud, but when they have to document it, they can't. It begins to tell you it is a lie. It is a lie that is designed then to provide the justification for massive voter suppression. And that's what we have to understand.
And Chris Kobach lost his race
in
Kansas. And then we also saw a couple other seats flip. The Democrats took control of Secretary of State jobs in Michigan, Colorado, and Arizona.
Yes.
How significant is this? Is pretty significant, right?
That is huge. It is huge. And we also saw, like in Michigan, which is a heavily gerrymandered state, that is where the power is disproportionately in the hands of Republicans, while the population is not that disproportionately leaning in that way. But that's what a heavily gerrymandered state will do. Well, these citizen-driven ballot initiatives have now provided for automatic voter registration, a nonpartisan redistricting commission. I mean, all of these mechanisms to open up access to the ballot box to American citizens. I mean, so this is what we're seeing. This midterm election was really a clash between those who want to deny access to the vote, access to the ballot box, and deny American citizens their basic rights, and those who are fighting tooth and nail for democracy to actually mean democracy. So the struggle continues, and thank you for this show, because we realize that voters, the need for to discuss the what voter suppression is, how it works, why it works, is not just a conversation a week or 2 months before the election. Thank you, Rose.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for all of your amazing work. Carol Anderson is professor of African American Studies at Emory University and author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. We have time for a few more calls. Let's go to Susan in Oakland. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to mention that it would be good, I think, if we all would contact our reps and try to get them to write legislation to push for voting by mail in all states, because it seems like voting by mail would take care of so many voter suppression problems. You wouldn't have to worry about ID or lines or polling stations or travel problems. Anyway, that's my thing, voting by mail.
Well, thank you, Susan. Carol, what do you think about that, voting by mail?
I think it's one of the solutions. One of the things that we would have to think through are issues of those who are homeless. It is a part of the solution that we need to think about, and I know that Oregon does it, and I believe Washington does it. But it's that kind of thinking through, how do we open up access to the ballot box is the kind of thinking we need to have. And we need to, and that's one of the things that I have found to be very hopeful, frankly, is that we are talking about this now. We are talking about, how do we secure the right to vote for American citizens? That's a conversation we haven't had for a long time. And I'm glad we're having it. We're thinking about it in terms of, for instance, machines where that are auditable that leave a paper trail, because Georgia's don't. Georgia's machines run on Windows 2000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I love these examples, but I just think the people behind these laws are ruthless. And
yes,
they're good. They're very good at what they do. I mean,
yes,
John Roberts, the Supreme Court justice who issued that opinion in the voted for the Voting Rights Act. I mean, he has been involved for decades in this kind of crusade, really, against the Voting Rights Act.
Exactly. Exactly. And his mentor was William Rehnquist, who would eventually become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Rehnquist got his start in Arizona doing one of those kind of true the vote things, where they would send out, his group would send out postcards to registered voters in minority neighborhoods. And if those postcards, if they didn't get those postcards back or something, then they would challenge those folks at the polls. And so you got voter intimidation happening at the polling station with, you're not allowed to vote here. You're not really registered to vote. You're not legal here. I mean, it was that kind of mess. That's William Rehnquist, who is John Roberts' mentor.
Wow.
And right. And so Roberts never believed that the Voting Rights Act was truly viable. He believed that it was punitive against the South, as if the South had done nothing wrong over many, many decades in terms of blocking access to the voting booth for African Americans. There was a moment. So in 1940, only 3% of age-eligible African Americans were registered to vote. 3%, because of the power of disfranchisement with the literacy test, the poll test, poll tax, and then, of course, with Election Day terrorism. By the time we get into the early 1960s, there are counties in Alabama that have 0% African Americans registered to vote.
Wow.
Zero. And so this kind of you are picking on the South is just is fiction. But the Voting Rights Act also was nationwide, because if there were jurisdictions that were violating the voting rights of their minority citizens, Excuse me. So sorry. If they were violating the Voting Rights Act, that has never happened before. Violating the Voting Rights Act of their citizens. Then they came under the preclearance guidelines of the Department of Justice. So there are areas in California, there are areas in Alaska, there were areas in Arizona, areas in Massachusetts, areas in New York that also came under the Voting Rights Act. John Roberts ignored all of that. And so what we see is that the 2016 election was an election based on voter suppression. That is how Donald Trump is sitting in that White House right now. Voter suppression and the Russians. Let's be really clear about that. Then we're looking at 2018, and we're seeing this massive battle between those who don't believe in the right to vote and those who do. All of that comes back to that Shelby County v. Holder decision in 2013, where five members of the U.S. Supreme Court did not believe that the Voting Rights Act was necessary.
Wow. And John Roberts, appointed by George W. Bush, who, as you note in your New York Times piece, it's so important to revisit all of this, won Florida by, 537 votes.
Yes.
Amazing.
537 votes. And that's only because the Supreme Court stepped in and stopped the counting, stopped the recount. And and you mentioned that piece in The Guardian, and I want to bring that up, too. Because even as we talk about recount, and that's one of the things Stacey Abrams was getting at, as they're recounting, you can only recount what is physically there. How do you count the people who were waiting in line for 3 hours and then had to go to work because the machines still weren't working? Right. How do you count the folks who were purged off the list, and no matter what kinds of IDs they brought, they still weren't able to vote? How do you count the people whose polling stations were moved so far away from where they could access it because they didn't have decent transportation that they couldn't get to the polls?
And Carol, to that point, I'm so glad you brought this up, because the one question I so wanted to ask you last time, we didn't have time for. In your New York Times piece, you have a couple of examples of people who were not able to vote. So you write about Floyd Carrier, 86, a Korean War veteran. He handed his Department of Vets Affairs card to the registrar, and he was turned away in Texas. Do you ever follow up with people who are turned away when they try to vote to find out how that affects them? And what do they do? Do they continue the fight? Are they so humiliated that they don't? I mean, I'm sure everybody's different. But what stands out for you when you talk to people who were turned away? And we only have about a minute left.
What strikes me is they feel this wound, because they walked in believing that they were full-blown American citizens. And when they're turned away, they feel absolutely devalued and debased. Their American citizenship has been tarnished. Some fight back. Some just go, wow. That's the response.
It's amazing. And Floyd Carrier, an 86-year-old, he's black, he lives in Texas, and he said, quote, "I wasn't a citizen no more. I wasn't."
Wow. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Right there.
Final thoughts, Carol. What is people who are outraged by this, what's the most effective thing they can do?
Continue working with organizations on knocking on doors, getting people registered to vote, and continue to hold your elected officials accountable. You call them, you email them, you send them notes to let them know you're watching, you're paying attention.
Carol Anderson is professor of African American Studies at Emory University and author of One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Carol, thank you for all of your work. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you back to continue this conversation.
Thank you so much, Rose. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about open enrollment for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. It runs through December 15th. If you have any questions about pricing and the quality of coverage, I hope you can join us tomorrow. You can call us when we're live, or you can email us your call at kalw.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Thank you.